strong opposition against the ruling military junta demanding a transition to civilian rule. Well, protests are nothing new to Sudan, where former leader Omar al-Bashir was deposed through a military coup in April 2019. After ruling over the country for 3 decades, in August of the same year, a transitional civilian military administration was founded to run the country. However, Sudan's military chief staged a coup and dissolved the fragile government. Abdallah Hamdok, the then prime minister, and other civilian leaders were all held in military detention. Hamdok was later released and signed a power-sharing deal with the junta. On Sunday, though, Hamdok resigned, leaving the military fully in charge. He said that Sudan was at a dangerous crossroads, threatening its very survival. Joining us on Spotlight, we have African affairs expert Lawrence Freeman, who's with us from Baltimore. And also journalist and African affairs expert Mubarak Henya is joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Freeman in Baltimore. Sir, why, in your opinion, has Sudan's democratic revolution been put on hold?
There are many reasons for this, and it's much more complicated than the average person thinks and gets from the media. There are no real thinking in advance of what would happen with the removal of Bashir. And now that when Bashir was removed, everybody really didn't have an idea of what's supposed to happen. And therefore, the situation has been very difficult for the last 2 years. The military is not used to ruling. The military is not used to dealing with the civilian government or demonstrators. You had the role of the security forces, which have been kept out of the current situation now for a number of months. You have a number of outside countries involved, including United Emirates, Qatar, Israel, Egypt, primarily. And then you have among the demonstrators themselves, you have legitimate students and demonstrators who want a better way of life. And then, of course, you have agitators, professionals using tear gas, Molotov cocktails, etc. So it's a very complex situation. The underlying problem that the current transition is having and that the government had under Bashir is that the economy is the key, that people's standard of living has not improved. Hamdok does not actually have a lot of credibility with people in Sudan or even outside of Sudan. They need to bring in people who are going to put forward a plan for economic development that represents the real interests of the people of Sudan. Now, I don't know if Pahani has that kind of vision. It doesn't appear at the moment he does. But if we're going to change the situation, we're going to have to bring in a new policy, a new paradigm for Sudan that focuses on infrastructure, economic development, and raising the material standard of living of the people. I believe that until we do that, the situation will continue with demonstrations and killings for some time ahead.
Mubarak Henya, I'd like to get your perspective on what's going on in Sudan as well. What alternatives are there now that the civilian prime minister has resigned? The military has said it wants to replace the resigned Prime Minister Hamdok, but the junta has also been warned that if that happens without holding elections, it could undermine their own legitimacy and it'll also damage the democratic drive of the people of Sudan. What do you think?
Well, I think what is happening in Sudan is a continuation of what we witnessed in the North African countries, like Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt. And actually, the events in Sudan are replication, they replicate what happened in Egypt, where the military hijacked the popular revolution of the people who overthrew an unpopular regime in Egypt. So the Sudanese military is reading from the same script as the Egyptian military. They have been collaborating very closely with the Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. General Burhan in Sudan has been collaborating closely, and they've been sharing notes. So we are seeing a repeat of what happened in Egypt, in Sudan. And the military, the ultimate objective of the military is not to hand over power to the civilian, but to ultimately take over the control of the country through quote-unquote democratic means, where, like we had in Egypt, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi taking power. The same thing will happen in Sudan, is most likely to happen in Sudan. So the future for now looks bleak, and the situation, I believe, is going to escalate. And of course, as Mr. Freeman said, there is the involvement of trans-regional powers who want to control Sudan for their own interests. We have Saudi Arabia, we have the UAE, and we have also the normalization deal with the Israeli regime. I think this is a major factor. But despite the fact that civilians have been killed, almost 57 civilians have been killed during the recent protests in Sudan, we are seeing very little or no condemnation from the so-called international community. If it was happening in another country, there would have been UN resolutions, but because it's in Sudan and there is that major plan to, you know, to protect the normalization deal, so we expect the situation there to escalate.
Lawrence Freeman, the protesters, they are calling for civilian caretaker government. They want democracy, it's democratic aspirations. As our guest Justin Tehran mentioned, the outside world, do you think, is it doing enough to support those democratic aspirations of the Sudanese people?
But I think you have to be very careful when you use the word democracy, because the United States and the West have their version of democracy, which they try to impose on other countries, including African countries. I've been in Ethiopia many times this year defending the Ethiopians, State Department, their version of democracy. There are democratic aspirations, but the aspirations that are driving the people in Sudan, I was there many, many times, is the fact that they don't have a future that can see their economic development improve, that their children can have jobs, that they can have jobs, that they can have the housing and electricity and food and running water that is required by an economy. The problem is many of the proponents from the West who call for democracy leave out completely and wrongly the question of economic development. The other problem you have in Sudan is when it was finally freed from the British colonial powers, the military was a major national institution of the country. You had the military, you had the Secret Service, and you had the civilian service sector. And right now, the civilians are not represented. They don't have a powerful voice in determining the future of the country, and they don't have any policy. And this was one of the foolish things that the West did, is they demanded the removal of Bashir over and over again, indicted him, but they had no plans for what to do afterwards for the country. And now Sudan is caught in a geopolitical manipulation, where they recognized Israel in return for some favors they were supposed to get. But the country has gotten worse after the removal of Bashir than under Bashir, and it was pretty bad under Bashir. I was there. So there's nobody in the democratic, quote, reform movement or in the military that actually has an idea of what to do for the future of Sudan. And therefore, like my colleague on the other end of this conversation, I am too, do not see any grounds for improvement over the weeks and months ahead.
Mubarak Kenya, let's go back to an issue that you just mentioned earlier about the likes of the U.S. and the EU remaining idle if they advocate a democracy worldwide, as they claim. Why aren't they doing more in support of the protesters? Is it because Sudan has signed a pact with the U.S. on normalizing ties with Israel? Is that why Washington is most likely treading lightly here?
Yeah, exactly. Because you see, when we have a civilian government coming in power, this whole process of normalization with the Israeli regime ideally should be taken to parliament, and the parliament should approve. And the Sudanese people, as we know, over the years, they have been supporting the liberation of Palestine. They are, Hamas had an office in Khartoum, and they have been supporting Palestine. So if we are to have a truly democratic government in Sudan, devoid of external interference, this normalization deal, will be in tatters. And I think so. That's why the U.S. Is supporting this military government. And the other issue we have to mention here is that the current military rulers in Sudan, Al-Burhan and his deputy, they have been working, they have been part of the Saudi-led coalition, which is at war with Yemen, which invaded Yemen. And Sudan is a major contributor of ground forces, foot soldiers, actually, which we can say, who are in the front line in Yemen, fighting the Yemeni people. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia, their interest is in seeing that the current military regime or dispensation remains in power, because they are part of that situation in Yemen. And as we know, the Saudi war on Yemen is backed by the United States, backed by the Israeli regime. So all these factors will automatically lead to the Western countries supporting this regime in Sudan, and they will not speak out against the killing of protesters because they are supporting, they are backing, basically backing. They might speak, they might issue some resolutions for the media, but we know behind the scenes that they are backing this regime in Khartoum, and they are backing the killing of civilians. So the people of Sudan, I think they are very resilient people, and they will continue protesting until the government, the military regime, listens to their demands. And there is also, a danger of another coup within a coup, actually, in Sudan right now. There is talk that some junior officers, progressive junior officers in the military, might decide now, it's time to now replace the old guard who are working with the Western countries, with the Israeli right. regime, against the popular demands of the people.
Lawrence Freeman, who benefits from this disarray in Sudan? There have been allegations of foreign hands, as you also mentioned earlier, namely some Persian Gulf states and also Egypt, of going to extremes to support the junta in Sudan. Why is that?
Well, first of all, when Bashir was overthrown and the West immediately came in and said, if you go with us on our Israeli policy, we'll make some changes in the size of your debt. Basically, Sudan has become, over the last 2 years, has lost its sovereignty. There is actually no longer an independent sovereign Sudan. And you have various forces in the world, you have geopolitical forces in the world who are using Sudan. Some are using Sudan to carry out their maneuvers with agreements with Israel and alliances with Israel. Some are using Sudan to join with Egypt to go after the Ethiopians on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which is unfair. And you have geopolitical forces of financial political elites that would rather see disruption, war, and destabilization than actually stable governments. And this crowd that calls for democracy, I think we have to look at them very carefully in the Biden administration. We saw in the Obama administration, you mentioned Libya earlier, The overthrow of Gaddafi, which was unwarranted, led to the destruction of the Sahel, which we are paying for now 10 years later. And therefore, this was not a productive move. What we need in the West, in my country, particularly the United States, is we need to have a new vision for Africa. We never really helped Sudan previously, and we're not helping Sudan now. Unless we have a vision that incorporates massive economic development and infrastructure, we're not really helping the people of Sudan. And in the democracy movement and the demonstrators, it's good to demonstrate. I demonstrated quite a bit in my life. But what is your policy? Who is putting forth a policy for the future of a stable, economic, prosperous Sudan? No one is at this point. And until that occurs, we have a major problem, and I don't think the demonstrations are going to stop. And I'm looking for some leadership to emerge that actually has a vision for Sudan for the future.
Muammar Kenya, we're talking about foreign hands at play in Sudan. The Saudis come up there, the Emiratis, and also Egypt. What do each have to gain here, and why would they have any say in what's happening in Sudan?
Well, Egypt is, as we know, is a neighboring country of Sudan, same with Saudi Arabia across the Red Sea. But they are not acting as good neighbors because, as you know, as I said earlier, the Saudis have used the Sudanese army to invade neighboring Yemen. And as Mr. Freeman mentioned also, that as far as the Renaissance Dam is concerning Sudan, the Egyptians are also using Sudan to, you know, check on Ethiopia, and they are part of that escalation happening in Ethiopia. So, and the Emiratis also, as we know, they are also involved in Yemen. So all these regional powers, they are not acting in the interests of the Sudanese people, but they are using Sudan as a tool to achieve their geopolitical objectives across the region, and not in the interests of the Sudanese people, because Sudan is a country with great potential, great agricultural potential, which can feed Africa. Sudan is also a country with great intellectual potential, but all these potentials have been undermined over the years. And now it's a country moving towards the status of a failed state, which is very unfortunate. I think that's why the people of Sudan have to, you know, sustain their protests. They have to demand that a civilian government comes in power, which is, you know, elected by the people. And unless this happens, we are going to see the military selling out the country. Because as we also know that the Sudanese military controls the economy of Sudan, fully controls the economy of Sudan. Almost all these sectors are controlled, negatively controlled actually, by the military. So the military has an appetite of staying in power and exercising control, because it's in the interest of the generals to stay in power, because they are personally benefiting from being in power. But the lower ranks in the military, they do not see any interest in them, for example, going to fight in Yemen, because young people are dying, young Sudanese are dying for a war that is not theirs. They have no interest. They're going to kill, they are killing their brothers in Yemen. So there is also discontent within the lower ranks of the military in Sudan. So as long as these foreign powers are not acting in the interest of the Sudanese people, and they will not for now act in the interest of the Sudanese people, we are going to see any changes. And the other thing also we have to remember is that the reason why these Arab regimes like Egypt and the Saudi Arabia and the UAE do not want to see a civilian power in place in Sudan, because that will act as an inspiration to other countries. It will act as an inspiration even to Egypt, that the Egyptians will also rise up against the military rule in their country. They will rise up against undemocratic regimes in other parts of the Arab world. So they do not want to see Sudan setting an example or being a trendsetter for other Arab countries. And that's why they're really interested in suppressing the popular uprising of the Sudanese people.
Okay, one last question for Mr. Freeman. These democratic movements, historically speaking, do they have a chance at longevity in these African and Arab countries where a so-called president or a military strongman has held on to power for so long?
Well, I think they absolutely do. The problem is you can't look at this, the situation in Sudan, isolated from the whole situation in Africa. Africa is the only continent that went through 400 years of slavery, which was a mass deportation of people. Went through 100 years of colonialism. Went through another several decades of neocolonialism. So African countries have not been allowed to develop. Many of the leaders in the 60s who were visionaries were either eliminated or assassinated. Even the situation with Gaddafi, who is not a friend of mine, I was not a fan of his, but he had some very strong policies for development. All of these leaders in the history of Africa has not been conducive to developing stable leadership. And outside forces, like the political financial elites in Paris and London and Washington and New York City, they have made sure that there is not development in Africa. There's not the development of roads and infrastructure, such as the Chinese are doing now. So this problem of having stable governments has been a problem that's been also imposed on Africa. And I agree with my colleague. None of these outside forces have the interest of Sudanese at heart. And this is something I've been fighting for many years. Even the separation of South Sudan, the people behind that in the United States did not have the interest of Sudan at heart. If you care about the Sudanese people, then they need electricity. They need clean water. They need transportation. They need good hospitals and health care. And that policy has to come with a civilian government. It can't come after it. And we have to fight for those policies in Sudan today and for a representative government.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. African Affairs expert Lawrence Freeman joining us from Baltimore. And journalist and African Affairs expert Mubarak Kenya joining us from Tehran. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us here on Spotlight. And also allow me to thank my guests for staying with us on edition of the show. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran.
I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. Look how they strike for you comparisons, but they have strayed, so they cannot find a way.
Brothers and sisters, as you have been with us, we were discussing the ninth verse of the chapter, which starts with a preamble talking about the bounties awaiting the apostle. انظر كيف ضربوا لك الأمثال فضلوا. Behold how they strike similitudes for you, but they have gone astray. فلا يستطيعون سبيلا. So they shall not be able to find a way. They shall not be able to find a way to the truth, to the right path. This verse was in response to the arguments and those seeking pretexts of the pagans against the Holy Prophet. The pretext mentioned in the previous verses were about the messenger eating food, walking in the markets, and not having an angel accompanying him to be a warner with him. And then at the end, not having a treasure bestowed on him, and not any kind of garden to eat of it. So at the end, they claimed that you are following a bewitched man. إن تتبعون إلا رجلا مسحورا. You follow none other than a man bewitched. In this verse, when it says, انظر كيف ضربوا لك الأمثال, means at first it says, behold, انظر. So you have to pay close attention to the pretext seeking of the pagans, of the enemies. And you have to explain them to your people. Because your people need to know that wrong similitudes will cause deviation in your community, in your people. And somehow this verse is trying to tell us that letting go of the wisdom, letting go of logic, letting go of the real character of the Prophet, his miracle, and letting go of these things and going for treasures, going for wealth, and going for status, this is what we call misleading. فضلوا, the verse says.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أنتم الفقراء.
Insights into the Holy Quran
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Another matter that we must pay attention regarding this verse is that the enemies of the Prophet ﷺ, they used to accuse him of being sorcerer and sometimes being bewitched. Though some of the commentators say that being bewitched perhaps means being sorcerer, because in the Arabic language, sometimes past participle is used as subject. But apparently these two words are different. If they called him sorcerer, it was because his words somehow extraordinarily influenced the hearts of the people. They did not want to accept this fact, but they could see in the society that everybody is listening to him. Therefore, they resorted to the accusation of being sorcerer. Being bewitched means to be mentally and intellectually influenced by the sorcerers and to have distorted senses. This accusation somehow originated from this fact that he broke the tradition. He somehow swam against the stream. He had different ideas, different thoughts, and his ideology was completely different and against the personal interests of the society. There were some superstitious habits and customs in the society prevailing, but his ideology was completely against them. And we tried to answer to all of these accusations in the previous programs. And we are done with this verse. In the next verse, similar to the previous one, the Holy Prophet ﷺ is addressed, and the verse somehow says, with the intention of scorning their words, that for you as my Prophet, there will be gardens beneath which rivers flow, and they don't have the eyes, they don't have the hearts to realize this fact. We'll talk about the 10th verse completely and sufficiently, God willing, in the next program. We ask the Almighty Allah to sit us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Skuse and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
We illuminated history. They lied. We illuminated history.
And this is a victory for Bristol. This is a victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the courts accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you can get longer for pulling down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston Four trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's checkered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days. But he's finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity. Thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Music.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, "stop the steal." His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceived the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts expressed shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American-Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States. Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stress on the need of unity among Muslims and call on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the US to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam, like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis and all Muslims, because there has been so many criminal activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahle Bayt alayhimus salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending US-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. 2 decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purizap, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We've declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as a real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Allies believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belongs to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level.
The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Caskets draped in Iranian flag contains the bodies of 150 Iranian soldiers whose remains have recently been found more than 3 decades after the end of the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. The mourning procession in Tehran is part of a larger national event which saw similar memorial services held for 100 more martyrs in 24 provinces across the country. The funerals were attended by Iranian military and state officials, as well as thousands of Iranians, to pay tribute to the martyrs, and also to observe the second anniversary of the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian military figure, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
We have returned, and now the people are greeting those martyrs who have sacrificed their lives. General Soleimani also was a personality who has sacrificed his life in order to maintain the security of our country. Now this is a coincidence with the second anniversary of martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, and now they have returned. As you can see, everyone is holding the picture of General Qasem Soleimani, and this shows a reminder of the job that General Soleimani has done for our country.
General Soleimani fought for the security of our country and the region. He pushed back the terrorists, and this made him as a popular figure in the region.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was assassinated in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Soleimani is highly revered in the region for his anti-terror efforts and his role in eradicating Daesh terrorists from Iraq in 2017.
General Soleimani spent all his life fighting for our security, once in the Iraq-Iran war and then in the fight against terrorism. the U.S. assassinated him because he did not allow the terrorists to take over the region. The U.S. was with the terrorists.
We are all Qasem Soleimani. The United States thought in vain that if it killed our general, it would disrupt his endeavors. But we all will keep his legacy alive.
General Soleimani began his career as a soldier in the IRGC in the Iraq-Iran War. While above 200,000 Iranians are estimated to have either lost their lives or gone missing during the war. Over the years, the country has been carrying out search operations to recover the remains of those missing.
The Islamic Republic always holds such mass ceremonies to honor its martyrs, and General Soleimani is no exception, as the country also regards him as a martyr and a national hero. Now, on the second anniversary of Soleimani's assassination, Iranians have been using any chance to pay homage to him. These people say this is to preserve what Soleimani stood for. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In the limelight.
The New York Times has recently reported that with Omicron surging in the U.S., economists warn that the 1-2 punch of expiring aid and rising cases could put a chill on the once red-hot economic recovery and cause severe hardship for millions of families already living close to the poverty line. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Huge Increase in U.S. Child Poverty Feared as Tax Credit Expires Amid Omicron Wave. Stay tuned for more. The lapse of Democrats' expanded child tax credit program at the end of last month has progressive lawmakers and advocates vocally warning of a major spike in child poverty in the new year, just as the Omicron variant wreaks havoc across the U.S., fueling a staggering rise in infections and hospitalizations. While some research suggests the highly transmissible Omicron strain causes less severe disease than other mutations, the enormity of the current wave is driving fears of widespread and potentially sustained societal disruptions, with disproportionate impacts on families without the resources to weather more pandemic-induced economic chaos. Approved as part of the coronavirus relief package that Biden signed into law in March 2021, the enhanced child tax credit provided eligible families with monthly payments of up to $300 per child under the age of 6 and $250 per child between the ages of 6 and 17. Recent survey data indicates that the payments brought millions out of poverty and helped many low-income families afford food. But thanks to the opposition of Senator Joe Manchin and every congressional Republican, the program expired at December's end, cutting off a key lifeline at what anti-poverty activists see as the worst possible moment. Rhode Island Poor People's Campaign recently said yet another sign of the misaligned priorities of this country. Programs of social uplift are sacrificed to the war economy and militarism. The New York Times reported recently that with Omicron surging, economists warned that the one-two punch of expiring aid and rising cases could put a chill on the once red-hot economic recovery and cause severe hardship for millions of families already living close to the poverty line. Anna Lara, a mother of two young children in Huntington, West Virginia, told the Times that without the boosted CTC, it's going to be hard next month. Just thinking about it, it really makes me want to bite my nails to the quick, Lara said.